Hi everyone, welcome to episode 5 of The Call of Nature, a UK nature podcast for everyday people just like you. Maybe this is your first time, maybe you're a regular. Either way, thank you very much for listening. We appreciate every single one of you. Now, we've got lots of great content this episode. We're going to be talking with Kat McNichol about her work reintroducing pine martens. Next up, it's me talking with Beth about her time in nature and how she shares that with people. Then Chris and Gareth are going to talk about tech that you can use to help you enjoy nature. Then Chris's dad talking about spiders' webs. But first of all, my favourite part of the show, the disclaimer. Chris.
The views and opinions expressed on The Call of Nature are those of whoever expressed them and do not reflect those of any other agencies or organisations.
That's superb work. Give that man a job.
I should work on like a radio advertising or something.
Well, welcome once again, everybody. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome, Gareth.
Hello.
And without further ado, let's hear about what people have been up to this week. Let's start with you, Gareth.
I've had like basically a bounty of delights to choose from. I've been really lucky this week. But last week, standard Saturday night, out moth trapping like all the cool kids. And it was, yeah, I know, but you were probably doing it as well, weren't you? So there were moths everywhere. It was a really good night. And there's just noticed that there's this thing flipping around. And it was a bat. And it'd been a clear night. So I'd lie down in a nice blanket, looking up at the stars. And there's literally less than a meter from my face. This bat was going around and hoovering up on my moths. And I've got to be honest, I felt a little bit bad. But there was one point where it was about 30 centimeters away from my nose. And it was chasing an elephant hawk moth. And there's like this midair dogfight between the two. And the moth did get away. It sort of dropped to the ground. But it was amazing to watch.
Wow. What a thing to see.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. So a nocturnal dogfight right in front of your face.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Who were you rooting for, Gareth?
Well, at that stage, I was definitely rooting for the moth because I felt that I'd already done my part in this sort of reduction in moth abundance in my garden.
Yeah. My moth trap bulb was mysteriously broken the other day after stuff had got moved around in my shed. So I wasn't moth trapping on Saturday, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but it's all right. I'll get on the internet, get another one.
Perhaps the neighbours are fed up with having their bedrooms illuminated all night.
Maybe. They're very understanding. I did have to go round and explain to them what was happening beforehand when I first got the trap.
Yeah, I'm sure. So what have you seen this week, Chris?
Well, I have nothing to compare to Gareth, I'm afraid. I think my highlight this week was I was sitting in my lounge the other day, and I heard a sort of weird squeaking noise from outside in the garden. I had the doors open to the garden. And I was like, what's that? And I looked down and there was a couple of cats right by the back door. And I was like, what are they doing? Cats don't squeak. And what they were actually doing was tormenting a little frog. So I dispatched the cats. I didn't kill them. I just told them to go away. And rescued this little squeaking frog. I didn't know frogs squeaked when they were being attacked, but so now I know that.
Mm. Well played, well played. My experience that I've chosen this week was a modest one. I went for a walk with a friend at a beautiful park, this huge park in the middle of Exeter. You'd think you're in the countryside. It's called Ludwell Valley Park. They seem to be dotted around Exeter all over the place, these things. They're run by the Wildlife Trust, Devon Wildlife Trust, and they're all beautiful. And while I was there, I saw a newly emerged peacock butterfly. So we've been seeing, as every year, last year's peacock butterflies, which are all a bit tatty, the ones that hibernated over winter. But that was the first one of the newly emerged crop from this year that I saw, and the coloration so beautiful, and it was just nice to see such a commonplace creature just move me so deeply. So that was my moment.
They're great this time of year when they come out and they're really brightly colored. It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
It's like they're HD butterflies, aren't they?
That's exactly
yeah. Well put.
Okay, so first up, we have a chat we had with Kat McNichol, who is a doctor and a specialist in mammals and has been leading the charge of bringing pine martens back to the Forest of Dean for the first time in well over 100 years. So let's hear what Kat had to say.
As a non-sciencey person myself, and representing some of the less sciencey listeners, we're talking about reintroductions here. So what is a species reintroduction and why do we do them?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So reintroductions are kind of the return, or, I mean, it's really hard to explain reintroduction without using the word, but it's the return of an animal or a plant to an area where it was once found but is no longer found, whether that's because it became extinct or it left the area of its own accord. And so that's really what a reintroduction is. It's kind of restoring a plant or an animal to somewhere that it originally was.
Just sort of thinking about how people think about, like, my parents are from the Isle of Wight, and they heard about these white-tailed eagles coming back, and they're like, oh my God, what on earth are these things? And they had this really like adverse reaction, and they're really worried about it. And literally 3 months later, it's like the best thing that's happened to them. So it's quite a strange change they've gone through. But when you talk to people, you know, about pine martens and things you've been involved with, Kat, like, what sort of reactions do you get?
Usually confused faces, because no one knows what a pine martin is. A pine martin is, so it's a mustelid, which is a group of animals that includes badgers and otters, stoats and weasels. So it's a kind of really long house cat with short legs would be the best way to describe it. And then people just seem quite interested, because I think most people don't know anything about them. And it is quite exciting, I think, because they're carnivores and we don't really have that many native carnivores in the UK. The prospect of having another one back is kind of cool. So generally with people that don't know about them, it's quite positive. And then if people do know about them, the response is usually a little bit more questioning, in like, why are they coming back? What benefit are they going to bring? Are they going to eat lots of squirrels? So there's kind of that dichotomy, but I would say about 80% of people don't know what they are.
And interestingly, because not everyone will know, why would you want them to eat lots of squirrels?
So in the UK, we have a native squirrel species, which is the red squirrel. And then we have an invasive squirrel species, which is the grey squirrel, which has been here for over 100 years. So a lot of people don't actually realise that grey squirrels aren't native. They're from North America. And when they're brought over by Victorians, because Victorians thought they looked nice in gardens and were great accessories, they had a disease that they carried called squirrel pox virus, which is basically like leprosy for squirrels, or like scabies. I mean, that's a really bad generalization, but that's kind of it's like. And it kills red squirrels, but grey squirrels can carry it without it harming them. So as a result of that disease, plus the competition from the grey squirrels, so grey squirrels are bigger, they eat more, so they outcompete these red squirrels, and the red squirrel populations declined massively in the UK and is really only in pockets, mainly in Scotland. Everyone that, you know, like supports red squirrels and has, you know, major interest in the timber industry wants to get rid of grey squirrels because they're a problem for red squirrels, but they also cause a lot of damage to trees, which means that the value of the tree, if they're being felled for timber, massively declines. So grey squirrels cost the UK a huge amount of money every year just in management, but no one can seem to get rid of them. They're just like a bad smell.
It's weird because I grew up in the Isle of Wight, which is one of the places that has red squirrels, but I think up to 18, I hardly saw one. I remember going to Bournemouth, like they let me off the island for, you know, a day. And I saw a grey squirrel in a park, and it was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And I was like, you know, because it's bigger, it's right up in your face.
Because you'd only seen red ones as a kid, is that right?
Well, they're quite shy, you don't see them that much. So this was like, you know, right in front of me. I just wondered, do you reckon there's any place for grey squirrels? I mean, are they ever likely to go from Britain? Is there any place for grey squirrels in Britain?
It's a really contentious area. The squirrel world is very controversial within itself. I personally think, like, a lot of people, the only wildlife they see that's not birds is squirrels. You know, in your back garden, a lot of people get squirrels and they get a lot of joy out of watching them. So kind of from an engagement kind of way, squirrels are a really great part of the British fauna, even though they're not native. In that sense, they do actually have a bit of value. Because, you know, if you got people to name like mammals that they saw in their back garden, they'd probably say squirrels, hedgehogs and foxes. And so although people think red squirrels are cuter, and we're never going to get rid of grey squirrels. That's the thing. They are here to stay, but it's just trying to get them down to a number that we can also have red squirrels in the same place.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, from a human kind of interaction point of view, I do think they hold some value.
Okay, well, Kat is nothing but efficient and to the point, so ended very promptly there. But the real reason was her internet dropped out, just so you'll know. Yeah, what do you think of that?
I thought it was very interesting, Gareth, and I knew about the impact on red squirrels of grey squirrels. I wasn't aware of the impact on forestry. What that got me wondering is, what impact do they have on our other native species?
Well, it's interesting. It's one of these things of, it depends who you ask. There's a real sort of divide between people who sort of come at wildlife from a welfare angle and people who come from more of a conservation science angle. And it's quite a tricky topic. Now, as always, I find this quite frequently, birders are always worried about anything that possibly ever eats a bird. And there have been quite a lot of anecdotal reports of grey squirrels eating birds. But I think the actual evidence for them having a significant impact on bird populations is quite limited. And it's species like collared dove and blackbird where there might be a bit of an impact, but relatively common species anyway. I think the real impact on other wildlife is probably indirectly through the impact they have on trees, because they do stop the recruitment of new mature trees, and having a really good complex woodland structure is important to so many species. So this impact on trees, because trees are such an important part of a habitat, it therefore affects a lot of other species.
Wow. I guess I failed to trip him up there, didn't I, Chris?
Well, yeah, Gareth's always on top of the science of these things. I found Kat's our chat with Kat really interesting, and I noticed just this week, actually, on the news that there'd been some success in that project. Is that right, Gareth?
Yeah, it was. It was the sort of, well, it was the cute cuddly factor, which I always push against a bit. But even I sort of, there's a little sort of flicker of a tear, like when I saw some baby pine martens, which is really good news because they're breeding. And for every reintroduction project, what you want is the martens to start to be sustainable, and they're hopefully on the way to there.
Yeah, it's a really great project. It was fun chatting to Kat about it. So next up, we've got a chat that Pete had with Beth, and they talked about how Beth had experienced nature during lockdown and some of the things that she was thinking about doing differently following those experiences that she'd had with nature. So here's Pete and Beth's chat about that.
Welcome, Beth. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Pete. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And now tell me, have you always been into nature? And if so, have you been sharing it on social media for a long time?
I have always been into nature, I'd say for most of my life, but it was only really at the start of lockdown, I'd say, where it became a real focus for me, like going out and experiencing it more and enjoying it and then sharing that with people.
What was it about lockdown that made you feel like you should get out and do this more?
I think it was pretty much the fact that I knew that to stay sort of happy and healthy during lockdown, at a time when I wouldn't be able to socialise and see many people, that getting exercise and getting outside was going to be really good for me.
Yeah, I can really relate to that. It's something a lot of people do for mindful reasons and almost as a preemptive strike against their mood dipping, isn't it?
Yeah.
Going and spending time in nature. So I think it's great that you're doing that. But I'm particularly interested that you're sharing those experiences with others. What do you feel other people are gaining from those?
Well, I think some people, I mean, firstly, people do say that they really enjoy seeing the pictures, which is always really nice. But I sort of have made it sort of a bit of a goal, if you like, to learn about it, especially things which I sort of have known or seen or are really familiar to me and have been for most of my life, that I realise I know absolutely nothing about. And I'm sure other people are the same, such as like just stinging nettles, really common sort of plants that we all know really well to look at. And we might know a few bits and bobs, but just to kind of get a bit more of an in-depth knowledge about them and then share them, especially like interesting things, why they're good for the environment, or what, animals might nest on them, or, if they're a food source for some particular animal, then yeah, I like to share that.
That's a great idea, Beth. I love the idea of finding out more about those familiar things. Before I forget, how would people find your content on Instagram?
My username is Led Lady, so that's L-E-D, like Led Zeppelin, underscore L-A-D-Y.
Fantastic. Well, I should certainly be having a look at that. Thank you, Beth. Now, as you know, on the Call of Nature, we often ask people if they've got a magic moment to share with us. So how about you, Beth?
I have. It's taken me a really long time to figure this out because I've got so many, actually, from all the walks I've been going on since the start of lockdown. But I think the one that I've settled on was probably the first sort of wow moment when I was out probably about 4 or 5 miles away from home, just walking around in this part of the countryside that I hadn't explored before. And I just turned this corner into a field, and out of this tree, literally about 50 feet away from me, a red kite just flew out. And I just was completely taken back by how big it was, how amazing it was. And I just stood and watched it, and it just kind of circled and gradually sort of flew over into other fields. But that initial just moment of like seeing it so up close was just amazing and terrifying, actually, because they're huge.
Oh, that's beautiful, Beth. There's nothing like getting close to a raptor. Now, before I let you go, you used a phrase when we spoke previously, which stuck with me rather. You told me that nature had allowed the world to seem bigger when under lockdown. What did you mean by that?
I think what it was like this morning, I was just thinking about it and like how a lot of people, I think a goal for a lot of people is to sort of be enough, right? This sounds a bit cliche, but we kind of want to be enough for ourselves, right? We want to kind of, we don't want to rely on too many things to make us happy because like we should be enough for ourselves in a way. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose I was then thinking about like how walking became that almost for me. Like I don't want to live a life where I'm relying on lots of other things to make me happy. It's like nature is enough. Just being able to walk out your front door into a park and seeing birds and flowers and whatever is enough. So I guess that's where I was going with it.
So it's almost as if with a lot of the things that we usually rely on in society for our stability and our happiness, when those things are taken away, it turned out that nature was a ready-to-go alternative.
Basically, yeah. And I feel really like I felt a lot over during lockdown that, in fact, quite quickly I realised that I was living a really rich life even though I didn't have a lot of the things that I normally fall back on. Mm. And that realisation was really quite amazing, that whilst a lot of people were struggling with it, I was just having a really great time just going out walking every day. And, you know, you asked me about my magic moment, but I literally had about 6 this morning that I was just juggling in my head going, I really don't know which one to do. So I settled on the kite because that was the first one that really took my breath away, where I was just like, okay, that's amazing. And yeah, if I thought I loved nature, this has just taken it to a whole new level. And it was unexpected. Had no idea, obviously, that this bird was going to fly out in front of me. And that's what all these magic moments are, aren't they? Where you just kind of go, wow, okay, wasn't expecting that. And look at what an incredible, and how lucky am I to have seen it? That's what I always feel as well. Like, how lucky am I that I was just in the right moment at the right place and I got to see that.
I can so relate. And that's a lesson I think that we'd all do well to learn and to take with us as lockdown eases and into the future. Don't you agree?
Yeah, oh, totally. So when I realised that maybe the time to go back to work was starting to come around the corner, I was just started then to focus on like, okay, what are the things I've been really enjoying now? And how am I going to make sure that they're still a big part of my life when I am back at work and things start to ease a lot? And you do start to sort of, your diary starts to fill up with other, you know, social events and things like that. How am I going to make sure that I don't neglect this walking and nature and still make sure I'm getting out there and enjoying it? It's been a real lifeline for me, nature, and it can really easily be that for lots of people.
Wise words, Beth, and I really agree with you. You've really inspired me and I'm sure you've inspired others. So thank you very much for that and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, no, thank you very much for having me. It's been really fun chatting to you and I'm really looking forward to seeing where you go with the podcast and listening to more episodes as you release them.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Beth.
Pete, that was a really great chat you had with Beth. I mean, it's really moving, and like her commitment to recognise how beneficial it was for her health and that she wants to continue this. I mean, it got me thinking, you know, we're three people who love nature. What changed for us during lockdown? What are you going to keep doing?
Thank you, Gareth. And yeah, I was moved as well by what Beth had to say. And I think what I'm going to do is just redouble my commitment to deliberately going out into nature. I do go out into nature anyway, but I'm going to make sure I'm doing it even more regularly.
That sounds like a fun commitment to uphold.
That's great. What about you, Chris?
Well, one of the things which I've started to do for nature as a product of lockdown was get involved in this podcast. And hopefully, you know, hopefully we'll be able to reach more listeners and get more people involved in nature and love it as much as we do. And so I'm going to keep doing this.
Well, that's definitely pleasing to hear. I'll second that. But I think for my one, and it actually came up, apparently, like Darwin, his dad used to force him to make a constitutional every afternoon where they used to have a walk around the garden in silence, thinking about things. And it sounds a bit strict, but it's amazingly relaxing. And like what I've been doing after work when I've been finishing quite late, even if it's dusky, just going for like a quiet 15-minute walk, just trying to relax, unwind, think about things. And it's been brilliant. So I'm going to keep doing that.
Yeah, sounds good.
Well, there we go. Beth, you've inspired all three of us.
Next up, folks, Chris, you and I, we've always been interested in applications for tech around helping people enjoy nature, haven't we?
We have.
And I believe you and Gareth chatted about it the other day.
We did. Here it is. Okay, so if, like me, you enjoy spending time out in nature, but you're not always sure what you're looking at, I just wanted to share a few things that I've found where I can use my phone to help me out. So the first one is called Seek, and it's an app where you can use the camera in your smartphone to help ID plants. You just point your camera at it, and it uses some sort of AI magic to say what sort of plant it is. And I found this really, really useful. The second one is called iNaturalist, and they actually make Seek as well. And this is a bit more of a nature geeky one, but you can record like stuff that you've seen and log it. And that inputs into scientists who like take all that knowledge and can actually do some useful ecology out of the back of it. And I believe, Gareth, you sometimes use this to ID other people's sightings. Is that right?
I do. I ID stalk people. Anyone within a 5-kilometer radius, you post something up. And there's others like me, we're a whole network. We help to ID anything you might have seen, which is, I think, is really helpful. And I think people like me get a bit competitive about it. So there's a bit of competition in there.
And you get that smug thing of, yeah, I worked out what that was, which is always fun. Yeah, so that's called iNaturalist. Another one is called BirdNet. And that's one which takes audio samples using your microphone on your phone and works out what kind of birds are singing. And I found that amazing. It's something I only dreamed of a few years ago. I thought, if only there was an app that does this. And now there is. So that's called BirdNet. I'd highly recommend that. The one which I use most probably is actually, it's not nature specific, but it's called Google Lens. And what that does is it uses AI, artificial intelligence and algorithms to analyze pictures that you've taken. So I took a picture of a beetle the other day at work, this little black beetle with a blue sort of sheen to it. Any idea what that might have been?
My first guess was a green dock beetle of some sort.
Okay. Well, your first guess was wrong. Sorry. It's an alder leaf beetle.
Oh.
But I didn't give you much information, so you can have a pass on that one, Gareth. Yeah, an alder leaf beetle, but that was great. And you can use this for anything that you can take a photo of. So it's really good for insects and butterflies and plants and stuff like that. Anything that you can get up close and take a photo with your phone, Google Lens. And you don't have to have an Android phone to use it. It works on iPhone as well. And then the last one, and one which I probably found most enjoyable, has actually been social media, particularly Facebook groups. There's a group which I look at called Discover British Nature. And an example of how I've used it is the other day I went on a little walk with a friend of mine, Joe, and we saw a butterfly. It was a fritillary, and fritillaries from the top pretty much look the same. They're all kind of orange with dark brown or black sort of patterning on them. They're quite hard to ID. from the top. But we managed to get a photo of it. And I stuck it up on Facebook and on this group, Discover British Nature. And within about 10 minutes, someone had got back to me and said, this is a dark green fritillary, and this is how you tell it is. And they'd taken the time to point out all the bits on the wing that I needed to look at and stuff like that. And I just thought that was really nice. I thought it was an example of how social media can be a really good thing, particularly for helping people engage with nature.
Just you said that, can I give a quick honorary mention to the UK Moth ID handle on Twitter? There's someone, a guy called Sean, he runs it for free off his own back and does like hundreds of Moth IDs for people every week, and it's brilliant. So take a look at that if you're into moffing.
Yeah, that sounds really good, Gareth. So the handle for that is Moth ID UK on Twitter.
That's the one.
And the other ones I just talked about was Seek, which is an app, iNaturalist, which is also an app, BirdNet, another app, Google Lens, and the Discover British Nature Facebook page. So there we go. That's six ways that you can use your smartphone to help you engage better with nature and wildlife.
Well, nice work, boys. And if any of you missed the names of any of those things which the guys were discussing, then we'll be sharing those on social media soon.
Cheers, Pete. And one of the things that I always use iNaturalist for is for spiders. They're fascinating animals, but they're an absolute pain in the ass to identify. But luckily, we have someone who knows his spiders, and particularly his spiders' webs, really well. So let's hear Chris's dad talk about the wonderful world of spiders' webs.
Okay, so now I'm very happy to have a real nature expert who also happens to be my dad join us. And he's going to tell us about spider webs. So Pete's here with me, and Dad's going to... you do have another name apart from Dad, Martin Woolner. Hi, Dad. How are you?
I'm fine.
That's great. And thanks for coming on. You're going to talk to us about spiders' webs, is that right?
Yes, that's it, yes. I know a bit about spiders, but spiders is a huge topic, so let's confine ourselves to spiders' webs.
Great. Well, take it away. Tell us some cool stuff.
Okay, we're probably all familiar with spiders' webs, especially in the autumn when they all get covered with drops of morning dew. They look like sort of hanging up jewels everywhere. But, of course, they're out there now. Everywhere, because spiders are everywhere and they're active throughout the year. You don't see them so readily this time of the year unless you look really hard. But of course, they're all made of silk. Of course, other mini beasts and other creepy crawlies can make silk. They're caterpillars of moths and butterflies. The caterpillars, the larvae of caddisflies, they make silk for various purposes. But I might say that spiders' silk is very important. It's hugely important in their lifestyle, and it's rather clever stuff. It is different from the silk made by other beasties.
How is it different?
It's different in that it comes in many different types with different properties. It has a far wider range of uses than, say, the silk that a caterpillar might use. And it is considered a wonder material. It has fantastic properties, some of which we'll deal with.
Okay. So spiders can make different types of silk, is that right?
Yes. Not all spiders make many different types of silk. All spiders make silk. They're all capable of making silk, but they don't all make webs.
Okay.
We've got, something like over 700 different sorts of spider in Britain, and all of them can make silk, but perhaps only a third of them will actually make really big webs, the ones which you and I easily see.
Cartoon spider webs.
That's
the one.
Yeah.
What do the others make use their silk for, Martin?
Oh, they can use all spiders use one type of their silk as a safety line. You know, when you go rock climbing, you're supposed to belay yourself to the rock every now and then so that if you fall off, you don't plummet to the ground. Well, most spiders, when they're climbing around, lay down a strand of silk behind them and stick it to the surface every now and then. So should they be frightened off the surface by something, they can just dangle down and then climb up that thread and come back on the surface and carry on. Most spiders will do that, but silk is used for covering egg cases. It's used for all sorts of other purposes. But if you look at a big spider's web, like the one, the garden cross spider, which I think most of your listeners will have seen in the garden, it's a biggish spider, and the web itself can be, what, about a metre across? That has about five different silks.
Oh, okay.
And it's got a frame around the outside, which is of strong inelastic silk. Then it's got all the radii coming up from the centre. There can be about 30 of those. That's made of a thinner strand of silk. Again, pretty strong, but not elastic. And then the famous one, of course, is the spiral of silk, which goes from the centre outwards in a spiral hexagon, if you like. And that is the silk which is special. It is elastic. It is sticky. It's pretty strong. You can get an insect perchance flying into such a web. And if it doesn't get stuck, which it is supposed to, it will actually ping up back off again. It's that elastic. It'll get rejected by the elasticity of that sort of silk.
Amazing.
That's great.
Spiders have got seven different silk factories inside their bodies, and they can switch on these factories in what order they want, and they can combine the products of two factories to make a more composite sort of silk. It's amazing. The silk inside the spider is liquid, but the moment it either gets pulled out by the back legs of the spider or it gets squirted out under pressure, it goes from liquid to solid immediately. And if we could make spider silk or any of the silks in large amounts, it could serve fantastic purposes. A spider's climbing silk is so strong that if you were to attach one end of it and then let it hang loosely, it has to be something like 30 metres long before it breaks under its own weight.
Wow.
It is really very strong stuff.
Isn't it got more tensile strength than steel for its diameter or something?
Yes, yes. Yes, people have been trying to make it. It's very complicated. Protein molecules all mixed in. It's highly complicated. Yeah. It's also waterproof. There are spider's webs in some situations which can last for 10 years. So it's got a built-in antibacterial, antifungal component. But spiders, big spiders which make big webs can actually, if the web gets damaged by the weather or maybe a large bird pecks part of it to bits, the spider will come out, eat the entire web, and then regurgitate that material. It gets broken down into simple chemicals and remade as silk material again within 24 hours.
Wow.
So these big spiders can make their web entirely, a new web, every 24 hours if they really have to.
That makes me feel a little bit less bad about all the spider webs I cleared out of the way to try and get through my back gate.
Well, I already thought spiders' webs were amazing. Now I think they're even more amazing, Martin. Thank you very much. But there's a question which I feel sure that every one of our listeners will want to know the answer to, and that is, as an expert on spiders' webs, do they still freak you out when you get them on your face and in your hair?
No. I spend a lot of time creeping through undergrowth looking for all sorts of things, and I don't mind if I blunder into a spider's web. There are no spiders in this country of which we ought to be frightened.
Well, Martin, it's been lovely chatting to you once again. We've met before a couple of times, haven't we? And thank you very much for coming on and telling us all about your passion for and knowledge of spider's webs.
Oh, thanks, Pete. It's been a pleasurable experience.
Thanks, Dad.
Bye then.
I'll speak to you soon.
Bye, Chris. Yeah, see you
soon. I absolutely loved that. And I think, I don't know what your dad's profession was, but he missed his calling as a sort of nature documentary sort of orator, because it was a beautiful voice. But yeah. Pete, I wonder, did you have some questions about Spider-Man and if that's possible?
Yeah, well, it didn't make it into the edit, but I'm sure listeners will be itching to know the same thing that I did, and that's, can spiders actually fire their spider's webs in front of themselves like Spider-Man? The answer was, yes, there are a handful that can, but none of them are in the UK. And this is a UK nature podcast, so that got the chop. But there you go, folks, now you know.
Yeah, I think it was really nice speaking to my dad. He's always been a bit of a mentor for me, like getting me involved in nature as a kid. He still does a lot of volunteering. He's like a local legend in his corner of Berkshire. And I remember going out with me and my brother. We must have been probably 6 and 8 when we first went out as nature conservation volunteers with bill hooks and saws and loppers. Let loose in the forests, removing invasive rhododendrons. And I think ever since then, I was like, wow, this conservation stuff is fun, you know. But yeah, it was nice. Really nice to chat to him. That's it for episode 5. One of the things that I enjoy most about making this podcast, and I think the other guys do too, is that it gives us an opportunity once every couple of weeks to actually tell some people about some of the nature that we've seen. Because to be honest, not a lot of my friends are into nature as much as I am. So if you're someone like me who had to resort to actually making a podcast in order to discuss the stuff that you'd seen out in nature, then why not get in touch with us and join in? It'd be really nice to hear some of the cool stuff that you might have seen that week. It doesn't have to be as fancy as Gareth's nighttime dogfights. Not actual fighting dogs.
I just make it up.
Yeah. If you've dropped in halfway through the podcast, it wasn't an actual dogfight. or just some of the other sort of day-to-day, just appreciating some of the everyday nature that you might see around us, like a newly merged butterfly at this time of year. We'd really love to hear from you. So you can get in touch via our website or through any of our social media channels. So you have been listening to the Call of Nature podcast. We're off now to try and make episode 6, and you'll be hearing from us in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening. Bye.